Once again, we want to look at where we are. We, of course, are down here in Southern California, zooming right in on our church building there. And we're going to then go halfway across the world, across the Atlantic Ocean, Mediterranean, and into what we call the Near East these days, or I guess there's some other name that they call it now. But anyway, what we're looking at is the area around here. And, of course, we have Israel here that really is not an entity anymore to speak of. It's certainly not its own kingdom. It's just a portion of the Babylonian Empire. As a matter of fact, the Medo-Persian Empire is what we've been talking about. And so that empire stretched all the way over here to the Aegean Sea on this side and all the way down into it, and some of it, including Egypt and portions of Libya, and then all the way over here to the Indus River in India. It was the largest kingdom known to man up until that time, and was for quite a while, and probably is probably one of the bigger kingdoms or empires or whatever governments that's been known to man. What did we say that, or what did the book say that the extent of it was in square miles?
2 million.
2 million square miles. And what's the United States?
About 3 million.
So if we just compare the size of this kingdom to the United States, we'll see that about 1 million miles less, square miles less, but still 2 million square miles, a lot of miles. It's interesting to note that someone said, you know, you look at the terrain on this, and I'm not sure, I haven't studied the terrain on this. When you think about 2 million square miles, and you think, well, of that 2 million square miles, how much of it was habitable? And I believe somebody did a statistic once saying that like 90% of the people on Earth live on 5% of the available land. That the actual, there's about 95% of the Earth that simply is uninhabitable because it's mountainous or there's no way to live on it. You know, if you're down here in the desert or if you're up here in the Himalayas or something like that, you've got very few people that live up in that area. So it's interesting that there's actually a lot of open area, but it's not places that people want to live because it's very difficult for them to do so. I'd have to check on that statistic again, but it was something of that magnitude anyway. Well, as we were going through the lesson 35 slides that Mickey and I have, we realized that we'd gone through a number of the slides that we had here, but what I wanted to do is try and make sure that we understand when these things took place as far as, you know, what the years were. I do note that, for example, here on this slide where it says the captives are free to return, it says 536 B.C. I have other information from another source that's 2 years different than that. It really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. But I have that Cyrus permitted the return of the captives in 538 B.C. But be that as it may, it's true that way back when, that's when the captives were allowed to return. And so it's interesting to note that those folks that were taken away in the Assyrian captivity, as it says here, have been gone almost 200 years. So really, Israel is no longer home to them. But the most recent captives have been gone only 50 years. But there is something in the text that indicates that some of them wanted to stay. So that's something that we can understand. I mean, if you've been in a place for 50 years, you kind of have a tendency to consider it your home. We've lived here for 30 years and sort of kind of consider this our home, though. We don't much like Southern California a whole lot, but still, this is where home is, and it's always nice to get back to it when you're away. But we do see in the text, as we look in the book of Ezra, that it was their choice whether they were going to return or not. And so when we do look at it, though, we understand that the decree of Cyrus was that everybody was free to return. And I was reading in my secular history book here, the one where this guy who doesn't really believe in the inspiration of the Bible, though if you ask him, he would say that he does. I should never, you know, make side comments like that because now I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. They had a choice whether they were going to leave or not. And what he said was that when Cyrus came on board as the king, that really our text that we're looking at, the Bible, it of course emphasizes that the Jews were allowed to return home. And there's a lot of this discussion about that and the fact that he gave all of the implements that Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple and all that and sent it back home with him. But this wasn't just the Jews. All of the peoples that had been taken captive by the Assyrians and the Babylonians and such alike as that, Cyrus said, you can go home. It wasn't just the Jews that he says, well, you can reestablish your temple and I'll give you money and I'll give you... Everybody got that. So we have a tendency in reading the Bible to focus on just this, but we need to understand that people have been taken captive from many other lands. If we go back over here to the map, we realize that there, little Israel down here, but there were people all over the place that the Assyrians, the Babylonians, and perhaps the Medes and the Persians would have. Well, Cyrus was the first one of the Medes and the Persians, I guess. So they weren't taking captives; they were letting them go. So, but Cyrus actually, it turns out, was apparently a semi-religious man. And there was a lot of monotheism going on at that time. In other words, Cyrus believed that, was it Marduk or somebody like that, was the chief god or some such thing. And one of the kings, I forget whether it was Cyrus or not, but he took all of the idols and the gods and things like that and brought them down and stored them in one particular city, in his opinion, to keep them safe. And I believe he brought them down to the city in which Marduk was the chief guy, which I think was in the city of Babylon. And apparently that raised the ire of a bunch of the folks in those outlying areas, because now their gods had been taken away captive and taken to the city of Babylon and stored there. And apparently Cyrus had a completely different idea than what they had. You know, he thought he was protecting these gods, and they thought that he was stealing them. It's interesting to note that the Jews didn't have any problems with things like that because there wasn't anything for Cyrus to steal. Pardon?
The gold out of the temple.
Well, yeah, he took the gold out of the temple and all that sort of stuff. But there were no, supposedly, there was no idol of Jehovah God for him to take and protect in the city of Babylon. Once again, it goes back to the discussion about, well, these are our gods that are supposed to protect us, and it makes me think about the scripture where the man takes the piece of wood and he chops it up and makes a fire out of it and cooks his meal, and then what's left he makes a god out of it and falls down and worships it. Wait a minute, if this is the god that could protect you, what difference does it make whether you've got an idol of him or not? And they're going to take it down. You know, when, what was it, the Philistine god, was it Dagon? When the Ark of the Covenant was brought over there and put in the temple, and he fell over the first time, and they said, oh, no, and they set him back up. He thought, can't Dagon take care of himself? And then the next time he fell down, his hands and his head, was it? Or his head broke off and his arms. So, did you have a comment, Randy?
Yeah, I was just going to say that when Assyria took the northern 10 tribes, there was plenty to steal because they'd been worshiping idols there. That's
yeah.
why they were being taken captive.
Right.
So they stole their golden calves.
Yeah.
And their Asherim and
all those nifty things. Yeah.
And all whatever else they had.
But something they needed to bring back.
And then, of course, the southern kingdom was taken captive for the same reason. They were worshiping idols as well.
So right. I'm sure they did. Yeah. But interestingly enough, when they went off into captivity, what did that make them? It made them stronger in their worship toward Jehovah God. We don't see so much, anyway, the idolatry discussed during the captivity or during the return, actually. In the return, what's the major thing that we see that God's got a problem with them about?
Laziness.
Laziness, right. So they don't want to build the temple and what?
Intermarrying.
And intermarrying and things like that. John?
So I know that you let other people lose. It says in Ezra 1:2, this says Cyrus the king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kings of the earth. And he has appointed me to build a house in Jerusalem, which is new. So, I mean, from this, Cyrus recognizes that God is the Lord of heaven, that he's the one that gave. Cyrus recognizes he's the one that gave them all the kingdoms of the earth. He believes he appointed him to build a house. So yeah, I would say he does believe in God and that he gave him what he's got now. I guess the question is, he released a lot of people. Did he support them financially like he did these?
He did. Yeah. Jenny, did you have a comment on that?
I did. Yeah, I did a little bit of research on Cyrus's decree, and there's talk of the Cyrus cylinder that has essentially the decree written all the way around it. And in the decree that's on the cylinder, instead of talking about Jehovah God, it's talking about Marduk, and it's talking about sending all the peoples out and building the houses for all of the peoples. And so in the account in the Old Testament, it kind of makes sense that the Jews wouldn't be focused on what he's doing for everybody else, too, because this is Jewish history. So they're saying,
right,
well, Marduk doesn't exist, so we're going to talk about God, and it doesn't matter that he's building all the other temples because he's building this one. So I think it's kind of a sort of specific paraphrase of what Cyrus said.
And certainly it could be, since right here in verse 1 it says Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, that we could say that it was God, perhaps, that put this idea in his mind. I'm not sure that we could say that necessarily that Cyrus believed that Jehovah God was the one and only God of the pantheon. I think that... like you say, when we look at the Cyrus cylinder and we look at the references to Marduk in it, that indeed he was well sold on the fact that Marduk was the chief god among all the gods. but we realize also that Nebuchadnezzar made confession that Jehovah God was the God that created the heavens and the earth and was the God of heaven and earth. Yet we see in later statements by him that he simply didn't really believe that the way that we would believe that. I think a lot of the people back at that time felt that, well, yeah, you can believe in your chief God. That's fine with us. But just don't mess with us because we got our own chief God. You know, the religion of Ra down in Egypt, that was their chief God, but they had many others. And even though Marduk was the chief god of that particular area in the Iranian area, that doesn't mean that he was the only chief god. And that's where Cyrus or one of the other guys got in trouble when he took all those other gods and put them somewhere else for protective custody, whatever it was, so that they wouldn't get destroyed. a lot of the people were upset about that. But yeah, John, I see your point here because it talks about the fact that God is working here, that he's doing this, and perhaps it is God, the God of heavens, that made him do this, that made Cyrus realize that this was something that he needed to do. But I think we do need to realize also and take note of the fact that other people were involved. Let me see if I have that. I had that up earlier today. This one here, the... Oh, I have it on my external hard drive, so I don't have it here. anyway, there is a timeline that I have from Rose Publishing. Every once in a while, you may get an advertisement in your email, which you consider to be junk email, which is pretty much the case, from a place called Rose Publishing, and I think they're down below somewhere. They're very, what would you call it? I don't know if you call it Pentecostal in their views, but their views are very strange to me, though they consider themselves to be Christians. But they make a number of very interesting books, timelines, charts, and things like that that are very helpful in class. And you remember seeing that Mickey has the soldier's armor and all that sort of stuff. That's from Rose Publishing. They put that together. But you'll notice that on the chart that Mickey uses, he's got a couple of things blacked out because it's got really weird doctrine in it. So I have all of their books, and they have this timeline in there where I got a lot of my information from. And it shows a photograph of the Cyrus cylinder, which is interesting to see. I think that what John, what the point that we need to understand here, that perhaps that you're trying to make is that God rules in the kingdoms of men, and that's what God has said too, and He's made that point to Nebuchadnezzar, and He's made that point here in various other places, and I think that He's made that point to to Cyrus also. I just wanted to bring out the fact that Cyrus did not do this just for the Jews. He did it for everybody. And he was supposedly a rather good king. According to the timeline that I have out of Rose Book's timeline, Cyrus reigned from 559 BC to 530 BC. the return, according to the timeline that I had, was 538. Well, that doesn't make sense. Because it definitely says in the first year of Cyrus, he made a proclamation. So some of my numbers are not matching up here for some reason. But maybe this is actually how long Cyrus lived, but that was only 30 years. So anyway... if we go back to this chart here, talking about the fact that many of the Israelites stayed where they were, they'd been there for a long time, their choice whether to return or not, and on the second, and Mickey's already gone over these slides, but I looked up the numbers here, and if we look at Ezra the second chapter in verses 64 and 65, we see that if we count up the people, there's actually in verse 64, there's a total of the people. And it says, and this doesn't count the 7,337 servants and the 200 singers, both male and female. So we see that at that time, 49,897 people are shown to have gone back, with Sheshbazzar and Zerubbabel as their leaders to go back to Israel. They returned at that time in 536, 538 BC. And then, here's the point that the folks make in our book, is that there were no gods to return to the Jews, like there were gods to return to the other people. You know, Marduk, you go here, and, Fred, you go there, and George, you go there, whatever the names of their gods were. The only thing that Cyrus needed to return to the Jews was the utensils that were taken from the temple by Nebuchadnezzar. That was the important thing for them. 5,400 of those vessels were given back to them. The tasks ahead would not be easy. And I think, as we discussed a number of weeks ago, and Lynn mentioned that about how long it took to go from the north back to Israel. It took about 5 months. We could see that in Ezra chapter 7 and verse 9. If we look in... where'd my Bible go? Oh, there it is. Ezra 7 and verse 9 says... It talks about all the people getting there in the next one. And it says he came to Jerusalem in the fifth month. It says, for upon the first day of the first month, began he to go up from Babylon, and on the first day of the fifth month came he to Jerusalem. So you got month 1, 2, 3, 4, and he got there on the fifth month. So it took him five months to get there. And so quite a journey to get there. Of course, they had the little ones with them in verse 21, even here, where we see the summation of all the people that that went as far as the priests and things like that goes. If we go down to verse 21, it says here, no, this wasn't it. Oh, Ezra chapter 8. So here's the list of all the people. All of these people are named right here. And in verse 21, it says, "Then I proclaimed a fast there at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before God, to seek of Him the straight way for us and for our little ones and for all our substance." So when we get down here and start discussing about the second return, we'll see that though it gives a number, it talks about also the little ones. And but the number that's given up here says, for example, in verse 14 right here, it says, "With them 70 males." So he's only given the men of the congregation at this time. I think it's interesting to note, and I never realized this until I started studying for this particular lesson. We look at this book of Ezra, and we say, wow, Ezra must have been really old when he went down to Jerusalem. Because when this book starts, it's the first year of Cyrus in the year 538 B.C., and then when Ezra goes down to Jerusalem, it's 457 B.C. That guy was ancient. Well, it turns out that Ezra is not even mentioned in the book of Ezra until the seventh chapter. And so the story is not about Ezra in the first six chapters of the book of Ezra. I hadn't realized that until now. But if you just do a study in your concordance and look for the name Ezra, you will see that it doesn't pop up until right here in chapter 7 and verse 1. It's the first time that it occurs in the book of Ezra. And so that's an interesting thing to know. I started adding up numbers here, and I said, wow, Ezra couldn't have been that old. So anyway, it was quite a time, quite a number of years between the first return of the captives, the 49,000, and then the second return of the people that were more of the spiritual priestly people. Yeah.
And then when you mentioned 7-1, that completely went over my head. It's a whole different king, too.
Oh, yes, it is. That's right. Yeah. So now we're talking about Artaxerxes. We're not talking about Cyrus anymore. And I think it mentions Ahasuerus in there somewhere in between 1 and 6. So I think I have that written down here somewhere. It's also interesting to notice that Cambyses, who reigned from 529 to 522 B.C., in the letter that was written to get them to quit building the wall, that they called him Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes also in that letter. But the king that they were writing to was King Cambyses. Cambyses is never used in the Bible, so we have to go to secular literature to find out what that is. And so it was King Cambyses that was in charge at the time that this letter was written. They called him Ahasuerus and Artaxerxes. But later on, we find somebody else is called Ahasuerus. Which one is that? Who?
Xerxes.
Xerxes, the one that was in at the time of who?
Esther.
Okay. So that's why in some instances we look at these things and think maybe that was a title like Pharaoh or something like that. You know, it seems to show up in here in the text of the scriptures as though it were a name, but it's used a couple of three times, and it seems that perhaps it's it may be a title or something like that. Go ahead.
Well, if it were a name, it wouldn't be unusual if it were repeated. I mean, you
true.
Look at the history of the kings of England. There's like three names, and they just put numbers.
That's true.
I mean,
yeah.
So it's possible.
Henry VIII, I am right. So, yeah. So, that's true. And as a matter of fact, when we go down through I've got the list here of the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire, and even after we get out of our context, after Nehemiah is in Jerusalem, and goes on until about 432 BC. Then after that, we have Darius II, we have Artaxerxes II, and we have Artaxerxes III. They're not even discussed in the Bible, because then we get into the area of biblical silence between the intertestamental period. And so there's no discussion. After we talk about the return of Nehemiah to Jerusalem under the reign of Artaxerxes the once, I guess. So I don't know whether he was the first one or not. So, but yeah, like you say, we have a tendency many times to name our children or grandchildren after relatives. And most of these people are indeed relatives of one another. It wasn't until we got down to, I forget which one it was, but one of these kings was the start of the Achaemenian Empire. And after that, the Achaemenids were the ones that ruled that area from then on. It may have been starting at Darius II, or maybe even after that, that they weren't in a family lineage anymore. Somebody else took over, and then that was the they were the ones that ruled from then on. Let's see, what was I talking about? I don't know. Okay, so once again, I'm pretty sure that Mickey covered rather thoroughly, and of course I was gone for a while and missed one or two classes. So we realized that there were other people, even though these 50,000 Jewish people returned, there were still other people in the land. I'm not sure what the extent of their population was. There were a number of people there, though, that they had to sort of put up. And so these people returned to what they referred to as Judah, but it was one of the satrapies of the Medo-Persian Empire, of Cyrus's empire at that time. And so this summary slide is a good one to look at, and it's sort of what I wanted to put dates on, but really when I got down to it, it seems to me that there weren't really three returns or only two returns. Christy, can you enumerate whether you can come up with three specific returns? It seemed to me that I had seen that Zerubbabel comes down with a big bunch of people, and then Nehemiah comes down with like 1,700 priests and their families. And I thought that was about it. When Nehemiah came down, I think Nehemiah came down by himself. He just had, you know.
I'm not able to elaborate. I always remember that there were three. But
okay. I know that when Nehemiah came down, it was Nehemiah was the one that petitioned Artaxerxes, I think, to come down. Yeah, right. And he was down in Jerusalem for 12 years. He was in Jerusalem for 12 years before he returned back home, as it were, returned back to King Artaxerxes. But when Nehemiah came down, I looked at it a couple of times, and maybe I missed something, but I didn't see that Nehemiah brought anybody with him except those people that needed to come with him to help him get there. You know, just a few horses and things like that. So, but yeah.
Well, I think it may not have been large for the name of Nehemiah, but there were three purposes.
Yes, there were.
In terms of, at first, the first return was simply to reestablish the people. The second was to rebuild the temple. But the third purpose, Nehemiah and those few who may have came with him, was the fact that they still hadn't rebuilt the walls, and that was his purpose. So,
yeah, and I think here in the middle one where we talk about Ezra returning, it says he returns with the priests. And if we look at Ezra the eighth chapter in verses 1 through 20, Ezra the eighth chapter in verses 1 through 20, where we'd already been once, but it just enumerates all the people that are down through here. And so you can see, reckoned by genealogy of the males, 150, 200 males, 300 males, 50 males, so on. Anyway, I took my calculator and added all those up. And I went down through here and it says, of the sons of Pahath-Moab, Eliehoenai, the son of Zariah, and with him 200 males. So there's another one. It's actually 201 in that sentence right there. So I added them all up. It came to 1776. 1,776 males. But you recall, as we've already looked in verse 21 here, that it talks about the little ones. And so, just as we might consider the Exodus from Egypt and understand that our numbers enumerate the number of men that came out, we need to remember that most likely the vast majority of those men were married, which doubles the number, and a good number of them probably had children, which means since they all had, 12 children, that you can, triple the number after that. But we see that, say, nominally 1,800 people, men, came down at that time. So we could say that it's at least 3,600, 4,000, maybe 5,000 people came down at that time. So it's minor compared to the 50,000 that came down the previous time, but we see that more people are coming down. But in this one with Ezra, we understand that really the purpose of him coming down is as he's talking, as we see here, that it's Ezra's purpose to bring about reform in the things that's going on. Ezra is very disappointed about what's going on in Jerusalem, in the area down there, and things are just not going well. So he gets together actually a bunch of priests amongst that number to come down and help him. Lynn.
Before we move on to the spiritual side, in the first part of Ezra chapter 1, like that, down in verse 5, when it says, even everyone whose spirit God had stirred up to go up and to build the house of the Lord, it almost sounds like when you were talking about some of the people chose to come and some people didn't.
Yeah. Well, I personally look at less of a direct operation of the Holy Spirit here than it is of the people realizing that they had a mission ahead of them that they needed to do, and that was to reestablish their homeland, as it were, and the temple and things like that. And so when I read through this and say, even all whose spirit God had stirred up to go build the house of Jehovah, I'm thinking, well, God would stir our hearts as we read through the Word and understand what we're supposed to do and such like as that. And I'm not sure I would apply a direct operation of the Holy Spirit here, but it certainly could be. I mean, if we want to look at verse 1 and we talk about Cyrus, and it said that Jehovah stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, I don't think that Cyrus was thinking about the Jews. He was just thinking about, he was going to be a good guy and let all these people go. So, Jenny?
Well, it kind of reminds me of the Exodus, when the words that God told Moses to speak hardened Pharaoh's heart. God hardened Pharaoh's heart in much the same way that he probably stirred up the hearts of these people. He spoke something and it either made them want to go or made them want to stay. And so the ones that it made them want to go, that's how he stirred up their spirit, was by telling them they could go.
I guess we could liken this to the parable of the sower, that God's word was put forth. Some people listened, some people didn't, some people paid attention, and some people fell by the wayside, and others, were sturdy in the things that they did. So, there's reason for us to think that God may have done this, but I don't think he told 49,000, whatever it was, of them to go and didn't tell the others to go. So that's my opinion anyway. Juan?
Well, I also think that could have been one of those things where there was an option to give money and stuff. And
there was,
Maybe they couldn't go, if they had an elderly person in the family that they knew that trip would not make it, kind of thing. They might have chosen to stay behind or something to that effect, or they had other things that were there. I mean, you're right, I think some of them probably could have been selfish and been like, no, I don't want to have anything to do with that, but some of them, like you said before, some of them maybe had made that really home. So
yeah.
That was where they lived, there was nothing wrong there, and so...
I think one of our slides that we have mentions the fact that the people that decided to stay, that they helped these people go along. I didn't see a scripture reference to it, and I didn't look it up. But
Ezra 1:6, what? All those about them encouraged them with articles of silver, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, okay.
There's a couple of places where...
Yeah. This here is on the sixth slide that we have in this, about the Jews who stayed behind, helped their brethren with gifts to make their trip easier, and you said that's 1:6?
Uh-huh.
So if we look at one...
There might be another place where they mentioned something.
Oh, okay.
I think, too, I mean, with what you guys said, too, that God's word stirs our hearts.
Right.
You know, depending on the frame of mind that you're in. Even today, you know, the Bible's been sitting around here for thousands of years and on somebody's coffee table for whatever, and what makes them pick it up one day while they're somehow in a frame of mind, you know, the world around them works on them or whatever it is. So,
yeah.
Like I said, I don't think it has to be a direct thing. It was just here was an opportunity, and some of them were able to go and went.
Right. And what did we have? We had a discussion for a good portion last time about the providence of God. In other words, we have a tendency to think that the only operation that God performs on people is miracles. But His care and love for us is providential also. In other words, He can see to it that things happen, but these are not miraculous. They don't violate the laws of nature and science. We might think that, well, yeah, but that's, you know, sort of miraculous, but it's not. It's just God has His hand in the kingdoms of men. Joey?
There's such a thing as an amazing work of God that's not miraculous.
Yeah.
For example, we hear all the time people reference like the birth of the child.
Right.
Well, that's a miracle.
The miracle of birth.
It's an amazing work of God.
Yes, it is.
It doesn't. There's no rules of nature that were suspended, if you will. I mean, it's all within the rules of nature. So, while the birth of a child is an amazing work of God, it's not technically a miracle.
No, it's a natural thing. Yeah,
it's very natural. But let's not forget that it's an amazing work of God, and
right.
We need to keep that straight because so many people just misuse in ignorance, the word miracle.
Right, right. Yeah, miracle is definitely.
And like you said, we referenced recently in our study Book of Esther, and you see the providence of God running throughout that book. Yet I'm not aware of any miraculous event.
No, that's right.
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 As far as Haman getting what
right.
due to him and all that, God accomplished His work there without invoking any miracles.
Yes, He did. That's right. Yeah, there's no miracle involved in Esther's parents dying, as far as we know. He just said that they were dead. There's no miracle involved in the fact that what's his name, the uncle
Mordecai.
Mordecai took his cousin or niece, whatever it was, and raised her as his own. There's no miracle involved in any of the things that we see there, but we see God's providence, God's hand in the kingdoms of men working at all times here. Randy?
It's a miracle when a virgin gives birth.
It is.
Yes. That's happened once.
We saw that once. Yes. Yes, we did. So, yes, that was a miracle. The birth was not a miracle, but the pregnancy was. So, yeah. That's it's very
pretty rare.
Pretty rare. Yeah, I think we have a data point of one on this, don't we? Yeah. So, yeah, and there's so many things. You know, it's like people using the word hero these days. It's just so overused. You go, well, wait a minute. He's a hero because he walked out the door or something like that. He's a hero because he walked out the door and didn't trip on the step. You go, no. And so, miracle is used that too. You know, I'll look on Facebook, and I've got a cousin or two. You know, they're denominationally predilected toward Baptists or something like that. And there's one, and they you know, he'll show a photograph of a beautiful sunrise or a beautiful sunset and talk about the miracle. Well, the miracle was that God created the heavens and the earth. But since then, there hasn't been any miracle because there's been a beautiful sunset and a beautiful sunrise. You know, all of these things. But the miracle of birth is the one that's mentioned just so often. And it's not. The first one was. The first two were. But so Adam and Eve, of course, and that was about it. I guess we could say all the miraculous births of all the animals and such like as that back then. But it was a one-time good deal, just much like the virgin giving birth. That was it. All right. Let's see. I had these notes written down. Okay. So as we go down through the kings of the Medo-Persian Empire, we realize that Cyrus, who you'll also see referred to in historical literature as Cyrus the Great, came on board in about 538. I don't know why I have these weird numbers written down here. But anyway, and then the temple was finished, as near as we can tell, between the years of 520 and 516 B.C. So if we look at the time that there was the return, and then the time that the temple was beginning construction again, and then was finished 4 years later, that's the 16-year thing. Okay, remember we've always talked about in the last number of things that the temple lay idle for 16 years. Okay, well, if the return was in, I won't go with this number. I'll go with the one that we have in our outline here is 536. If the return was in 536, then we look at the time of when, of what year of Cyrus's reign it was. We realize that if the first year of Cyrus's reign was in 536, and then it says when the temple was started to be rebuilt again, it says the 16th year rather of Cyrus's reign. That means that it laid idle for 16 years. And then it was finished in 516, 4 years later, and then the temple was done. And actually, it was at the laying of the foundation of the temple that the old men wept. It wasn't at the completion of the temple. It was, so if we go back to the beginning of Ezra, when we see that they set up the foundation of the temple, we'll see that after they set up the foundation is when the old men wept and the newer people were happy about it. And then they built their own houses for 16 years. And then they got back and finished the temple. So we had Cyrus around for a number of years. The temple was finished pretty much. No, it wasn't. It wasn't finished until sometime during the reign of Darius the First. Yes, that's right. So in the interim period, we had Cyrus was there. Then after him was Cambyses, who we can see mentioned in the Bible as either Ahasuerus or Artaxerxes, not the one in Esther. And then after Cambyses was Darius the First, and he was around from 522 to 486. And then Esther was nominally from about 478 to 473 is when the book takes place. And, of course, we don't know how long Esther and the king were there, but Xerxes, the king himself, was around from 485 to 465. He's also called Ahasuerus. And then Ezra went to Jerusalem, took that five-month journey, and took about 1,776 males with him, and then little ones also, in 457 B.C. And then a number of years later, 13 years later, there was a second return with Nehemiah. And that was the second term under Artaxerxes. Okay, we'll look at some more of this on Wednesday evening.